Oliver Warren School walked in just far enough to say, "The voice analysis shows sufficient proof of lying." His announcement over, he withdrew immediately. Janes picked up a single sheet of paper and summarized from it. "This is a story appearing in a Rio paper this morning. It tells of the kidnapping of a Mr. Paulo Miranda. His daughter is Patrick's friend, Jack. We've checked with the authorities in Rio. No ransom demand, nothing from the kidnappers." He slid the paper in the direction of Stefano, but it stopped out of his reach. "So where is Mr. Miranda?"
"I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about."
Janes looked at the other end of the table. "Still lying," Underhill said. Oliver and Warren nodded their agreement. "We had a deal, Jack. You would tell us the truth, and we would drop the charges against you. And, as I recall, we agreed not to arrest your clients. Now what am I supposed to do, Jack?" Stefano was looking at Underhill and Oliver, who seemed ready to pounce on his next utterance. They, in turn, stared coldly at him, missing nothing.
"She knows where the money is," Stefano said in resignation.
"Do you know where she is?"
"No, she fled Rio when we found Patrick. No sign of her."
"No." Haynes looked at his truth squad. Yes, he had stopped the lying.
"I agreed to tell you everything," Jack said. "I did not agree to do anything else. We can still look for her."
"We didn't know about her."
"Too bad. If necessary, we can review our agreement. I'll be happy to call my lawyer."
"Yes, but we've already caught you lying."
"I'm sorry. It won't happen again."
"Lay off the girl, Jack, and release her father."
"I'll think about it."
"No, you'll do it now." The beach house was a modern tri-level in a row of seemingly identical structures along a freshly developed strip of the coast. October was off-season. Most of the houses appeared to be empty. Sandy parked behind a shiny, generic four-door with Louisiana plates, a rental car, he presumed. The sun was low on the horizon, inches off the top of the flat water. The gulf was deserted. Not a boat or a ship could be seen. He climbed the steps and followed the wraparound deck until he found a door. Leia answered his knock with a smile, a short one, forced through because she was at heart a warm person, not given to the dark mood swings which now plagued her.
"Come in," she said softly and locked the door behind him.
The living room was large and vaulted, with glass on three sides and a fireplace in the center.
"Nice place," he said, then caught a delicious aroma floating in from the kitchen. He had skipped lunch, thanks to Patrick.
"Are you hungry?" she asked.
"Starving."
"I'm cooking a little something."
"Wonderful."
The authentic hardwood floors creaked a little as he followed her to the dining room. On the table was a cardboard box, and beside it were papers neatly arranged. She had been working. She paused by the table and said,
"This is the Aresia file."
"Prepared by whom?"
"Patrick, of course."
"Where has it been for the past 4 years?"
"In storage, in Mobile."
Her answers were short, and each gave rise to a dozen quick questions Sandy would have loved to throw at her.
"We'll get to it later," she said, and dismissed it with a casual wave.
In the kitchen there was a whole roasted chicken on the cutting board by the sink. A pan of brown rice mixed with vegetables was steaming on the stove.
"It's pretty basic," she said. "I find it hard to cook in someone else's kitchen."
"Looks delicious. Whose kitchen is this?"
"It's just a rental. I have it for the month."
She sliced the chicken and directed Sandy to pour the wine, a fine Pinot Noir from California. They sat at a small table in the breakfast nook with a splendid view of the water and the remains of the sunset.
"Cheers,"
she said, raising her glass.
"To Patrick," Sandy said.
"Yes, to Patrick."
She made no effort to address her food. Sandy stuffed a large slice of chicken breast into his mouth.
"How is he?"
He chewed rapidly so he wouldn't disgust this delightful young woman with a mouthful of food. A sip of wine, napkin to the lips. "Patrick's okay. The burns are healing nicely. A plastic surgeon examined him yesterday and said that no grafts will be necessary. The scars will be with him for a few years, but they will eventually fade. The nurses bring him cookies, the judge brings him pizza. No less than 6 armed men guard him around the clock. So I'd say Patrick is doing better than most capital murder defendants."
"This is Judge Husky?"
"Yes, Carl Husky. Do you know him?"
"No, but Patrick spoke of him often. They were good friends."
Patrick told me once that if he was captured, he hoped it would happen while Carl Husky was still the judge.
He's retiring soon, Sandy said. What fortunate timing, he thought.
He can't hear Patrick's case, can he? She asked.
No, he'll recuse himself very soon. Sandy ate a much smaller piece of chicken, still eating alone because she had yet to touch her knife and fork. She held the glass of wine near her head and looked at the orange and violet clouds on the horizon.
I'm sorry, I forgot to ask about your father.
No word. I talked to my brother 3 hours ago, and there's still no word.
I'm very sorry, Leia. I wish I could do something.
And I wish I could do something. It's frustrating. I can't go home, and I can't stay here.
I'm sorry, Sandy said again, because he could think of nothing better to offer. He continued his meal in silence. She played with her rice and watched the ocean. This is delicious, he said twice.
Thanks, she said with a sad grin.
What does your father do?
He's a university professor.
Where?
In Rio, at the Catholic University.
Where does he live?
In Ipanema, in the apartment I grew up in.
Her father was a delicate subject, but at least Sandy was getting answers to his questions. Maybe it helped her to talk about him. He asked more questions, all very general and all far away from the kidnapping. She never touched her food. When he finished, she asked, "Would you like some coffee?"
"We'll probably need it, won't we?"
"Yes."
They removed the plastic rental dishes from the table and left them in the kitchen. Leia made coffee while Sandy inspected the house. They met in the dining room, where the coffee was served and the polite talk, such as it was, came to an end. They sat facing each other across the glass table.
"How much do you know about the Aresia matter?" she asked.
"He was the client whose $90 million got snatched by Patrick, if you believe the papers. He was an executive with Platt and Rockland, who had squealed on the company for overbilling. He filed a charge under the False Claims Act. Platt and Rockland got caught, to the tune of something like $600 million. His reward under the Act was 15% of that. His lawyers were Bogan and Company, where our pal Patrick worked. That's about it, the basics."
"That's pretty good. What I'm about to tell you can all be verified by these documents and tapes. We'll go through them, as it will be necessary for you to know this material inside and out."
"I've actually done this before, you know."
He smiled, but she didn't. No more lame efforts at humor.
"The Aresia claim was fraudulent from the very beginning." She spoke deliberately. There was no hurry. She waited until he absorbed this, which took a few seconds. "Benny Aresia is a very corrupt man who conceived a scheme to defraud both his company and his government. He was assisted by some very capable lawyers, Patrick's old firm, and some powerful people in Washington."
"That would be Senator Nye, Bogan's first cousin."
"Primarily, yes. But as you know, Senator Nye has considerable influence in Washington."
"So I've heard."
"Aresia carefully planned his scheme, then took it to Charles Bogan. Patrick was a new partner then, but he knew nothing of Aresia. The other partners were brought into the conspiracy, everyone but Patrick. The law firm changed, and Patrick knew something was different. He started digging and eavesdropping, and eventually found out that this new client named Aresia was the cause for all the secrecy. He was patient. He pretended to notice nothing, and all the time he was gathering evidence. A lot of it is in here."
She touched the box when she said this.
"Let's go back to the beginning," Sandy said. "Explain how the claim was fraudulent."
"Aresia ran New Coastal Shipyards in Pascagoula. It's a division of Platt and Rockland."
"I know all that. Big defense contractor with a shady past, a bad reputation for bilking the government."
"That's it. Aresia took advantage of its size to implement his plan. New Coastal was building the Expedition nuclear submarines, and things were already over budget. Aresia decided to make matters worse. New Coastal submitted fraudulent labor records, thousands of hours at union scale for work that was never done, for employees who never existed. It procured materials at grossly inflated prices, light bulbs for $16 each, drinking cups at $30 each, and on, the list is endless."
"Is the list in this box?"
"Only the big items. Radar systems, missiles, weapons, things I've never heard of. The light bulbs are insignificant. Aresia had been with the company long enough to know exactly how to avoid detection. He created a ton of paperwork, little of it with his name on it.
Platt and Rockland had 6 different divisions involved with defense contracting, and so the Home Office was a zoo. Aresia took advantage of this. For every bogus claim he submitted to the Navy, he had written authorization signed by some executive at the Home Office. Aresia would subcontract for the inflated materials, then request approval from a higher-up. It was an easy system to work, especially for a shrewd man like Aresia, who was planning on screwing the company anyway. He kept meticulous records and later gave them to his lawyers. And Patrick got them. Some of them. Sandy looked at the box. The top flaps were closed. And this has been in hiding since he disappeared?
Yes.
Did he ever come back to check on it?
No.
Did you?
I came 2 years ago to renew the rental at the storage facility. I looked in the box but didn't have the time to examine the contents. I was scared and nervous and I didn't want to come. I was convinced these materials would never be needed because he would never be caught. But Patrick always knew.
The cross-examiner in Sandy was ready to burst with another round of questions unrelated to Aresia, but he let the moment pass. Relax, he told himself. Don't appear eager, and maybe the questions will get answered eventually. So Aresia's scheme worked, and at some point he approached Charles Bogan, whose cousin is an ass-kicker in Washington and whose old boss is a federal judge. Did Bogan know Aresia had caused the overruns? She stood, reached into the box, and removed a battery-operated tape player and a rack of neatly labeled mini-cassettes. She picked through the cassettes with a pen until she found the one she wanted. She inserted it in the tape player. It was obvious to Sandy that she had done this many times before.
Listen, she said. April 11, 1991. The first voice is Bogan, the second is Aresia. Aresia had placed the call, and Bogan took it in the conference room on the second floor of the firm's offices.
Sandy leaned forward on his elbows. The tape began to play. Bogan.
I got a call from one of Platt's New York lawyers today, a guy named Krasny.
Aresia. I know I'm typical New York ass.
Bogan.
Yes, he wasn't very friendly. He said they might have proof that you knew about the double billing on the stalker screens New Coastal bought from Ramtech. I asked him to show me the proof. He said it would be a week or so.
Aresia. Relax, Charlie. There's no way they can prove that because I didn't sign anything.
Bogan.
But you knew about it?
Aresia.
Of course I knew about it. I planned it. I set it in motion. It was another one of my wonderful ideas. Their problem, Charlie, is that they can't prove it. There are no documents, no witnesses.
The cassette went silent, and Leia said, same conversation about 10 minutes later.
Aresia.
How's the senator?
Bogan.
Doing well. Yesterday he met with the Secretary of the Navy.
Aresia.
How'd it go?
Bogan.
Went well, they're old friends, you know. The senator expressed his strong desire to punish Platt and Rockland for its greed, yet not harm the expedition project. The secretary feels the same, and said he would push for a stiff penalty against Platt and Rockland.
Aresia. Can he speed things up?
Bogan.
Why?
Aresia.
I want the damn money, Charlie. I can feel it. I can taste it.
Leia pushed a button and the recording stopped. She removed the cassette and placed it back in the rack. Patrick started recording early in 91. Their plans were to cut him out of the firm at the end of February on the grounds that he was not generating enough business.
Is that box full of tapes?
There are about 60 of them, all carefully edited by Patrick, so you can listen to everything in 3 hours.
Sandy glanced at his watch.
We have a lot of work to do, she said.
Chapter 28. Paolo's request for a radio was declined, but when they realized he simply wanted music, they brought him a well-used tape player and 2 cassettes of the Rio Philharmonic Orchestra. Classical was his preference. Paolo turned the volume low and flipped through a stack of old magazines. His request for books had been taken under consideration. The food so far was more than adequate. They seemed anxious to keep him happy. His captors were young men working for someone else, someone Paolo knew he would never see. If they in fact released him, the young men would flee and prosecution would be impossible. His second day passed slowly. Eva was too wise to rush into their trap. One day soon this would make sense. He could wait as long as they could. His honor brought the pizza with him on the second night. He had enjoyed the first so much, he had called Patrick during the afternoon to see if they could do it again. Patrick was anxious for company. Husky reached into a small briefcase and withdrew a stack of envelopes which he tossed on Lawyer Lanigan's work table.
A lot of people want to say hello, mostly the courthouse gang. I told them they could write.
I didn't realize I had so many friends.
You don't. These are bored office workers with plenty of time to write letters. It's as close as they can get to the action.
Gee, thanks. Husky pulled a chair close to Patrick's bed and propped his feet on a drawer open from the night table. Patrick had eaten almost 2 pieces of pizza and was now finished.
I'll have to recuse myself soon, Husky said, almost apologetically.
I know.
I talked with Trussell this morning at length. I know you're not crazy about him, but he is a good judge. He's willing to take the case.
I prefer Judge Lanks.
Yes, but unfortunately you don't get your choice. Lanks is having trouble with his blood pressure, and we've tried to keep the big cases away from him. As you know, Trussell has more experience than Lanks and myself combined, especially in death penalty cases.
Patrick managed a slight flinch, a sudden squinting around the eyes, and a momentary sag of the bony shoulders when his friend finished the last sentence. A death penalty case. It seized him, as often happened when he dragged himself to the mirror for a long look. Husky caught every tiny movement. As they say, anybody is capable of murder, and Husky had chatted with many killers during his 12 years as a judge. Patrick, however, just happened to be his first friend to face death row.
"Why are you leaving the bench?" Patrick asked.
"The usual reasons. I'm bored with it, and if I don't quit now, I'll never be able to. Kids are getting closer to college, and I need to make more money."
Husky paused for a second, then asked,
"Just curious, how did you know I was leaving the bench? It's not something I've broadcast."
"Word gets around."
"To Brazil?"
"I had a spy, Carl."
"Someone here?"
"No, of course not. I couldn't run the risk of contacting anyone here."
"So was someone down there?"
"Yes, an attorney I met."
"And you told him everything?"
"Her. And yes, I told her everything."
Husky tapped his fingers together and said, "I guess that makes sense.
I highly recommend it next time you're down there disappearing."
"I'll remember that. This attorney, where is she now?"
"Close by, I think."
"Now I see. She must be the one who has the money."
Patrick smiled, then chuckled. The ice was broken, finally. "What do you want to know about the money, Carl?"
"Everything. How'd you steal it? Where is it? How much is left?"
"What's the best courthouse rumor you've heard about the money?"
"Oh, there are hundreds. My favorite is that you've doubled the money and buried it in vaults in Switzerland, that you were just passing time in Brazil, and in a few more years you would leave and go play with your cash."
"Not bad."
"Remember Bobby Doak, that little pimple-faced weasel who does divorces for $99 and resents any lawyer who charges more?"
"Sure, advertises in church bulletins."
"That's him. He was drinking coffee in the clerk's office yesterday and telling how he had it from an inside source that you'd blown the money on drugs and teenaged prostitutes, and that was why you were living like a peasant in Brazil."
"That sounds like Doak." The levity passed quickly as Patrick grew quiet. Husky wasn't about to lose the moment.
"So where's the money?"
"I can't tell you, Carl."
"How much is left?"
"A ton."
"More than you stole?"
"More than I took, yes."
"How'd you do it?"
Patrick swung his feet from the other side of the bed and walked to the door. It was closed. He stretched his back and legs and took a drink from a bottle of water. Then he sat on the edge of the bed looking down at Carl. "I got lucky," he said, almost in a whisper, but Carl heard every syllable. "I was leaving, Carl, with or without the money. I knew the money was coming to the firm, and I had a plan to get it. But if that had fallen through, I was still leaving. I couldn't take another day with Trudy. I hated my job, and I was about to get my throat cut at the firm anyway. Bogan and those boys were in the midst of a gigantic fraud, and I was the only person outside the firm who knew it."
"What fraud?"
"Aresia's claim. We'll talk about that later. So I slowly planned my escape, and I got lucky and got away. The luck followed me until 2 weeks ago. Incredible luck."
"We got as far as the burial."
"Right. I went back to the little condo I had rented at Orange Beach. I stayed there a couple of days, indoors, listening to language tapes and memorizing Portuguese vocabulary. I also spent hours editing the conversations I had recorded around the office. There were a lot of documents to organize. I actually worked quite hard. At night, I walked the beach for hours, working up a sweat, trying to melt the pounds off as quickly as possible. I completely disassociated myself from food.
What kind of documents?
The Eresia file. I ventured out in the sailboat. I knew the basics, and suddenly I was motivated to become a good sailor. The boat was big enough to live on for days at a time, and soon I was hiding out there on the water.
Here?
Yes. I'd anchor close to Ship Island and watch the shoreline of Biloxi.
Why did you want to do that?
I had the office wired, Carl. Every phone, every desk except for Bogan's. I even had a mic in the men's room on the first floor between Bogan's office and Vetrano's. The mics transmitted to a hub I had hidden in the attic. It's an old firm in an old building with a million old files stashed away in the attic. Nobody ever went up there. There was an old TV antenna attached to the chimney on top of the building, and I ran my wires through it. The receiver then transmitted to a 10-inch dish I had on the sailboat. This was high-tech, state-of-the-art stuff, Carl. I bought it on the black market in Rome. Cost me a ton of money. With binoculars, I could see the chimney, and the signals were easy to collect. Every conversation within earshot of a mic was beamed to me on the sailboat. I recorded all of them and did my editing at night. I knew where they were eating lunch, and what moods their wives were in. I knew everything.
That's incredible.
You should have heard them trying to sound serious after my funeral. On the phone, they took all these calls, all these condolences, and sounded so grave and proper. But among themselves, they joked about my death. It saved a nasty confrontation. Bogan had been elected to deliver the news to me that I was being booted from the firm. The day after the funeral, he and Haverack drank scotch in the conference room and laughed about how lucky I was to have died at such an opportune time.
Do you have these tapes?
Of course. Get this. I have the tape of the conversation between Trudy and Doug Vetrano in my old office just hours before my funeral when they open my lockbox and find a surprise life insurance policy for $2 million. It's hilarious. It took Trudy about 20 seconds before she asked, "When do I get the money?"
When can I hear it?
I don't know. Soon. There were hundreds of tapes. The editing took 12 hours a day for several weeks. Imagine all the phone calls I had to wade through.
Were they ever suspicious?
Not really. Rapley once made the remark to Vetrano that my timing was incredible, since I had purchased the $2 million policy only 8 months before my death. And there was a comment or two about how strange I had been acting, but it was harmless. They were so thrilled that I was gone and out of the way.
Did you tap Trudy's phones?
I thought about it, but then why bother? Her behavior was predictable. She couldn't help me.
But Eresia could.
Certainly. I knew every move they made for Eresia. I knew the money was going offshore. I knew which bank and when it would get there.
So how'd you steal it?
Again, lots of luck. Though Bogan was calling the shots, Vetrano was doing most of the talking with the bankers. I flew to Miami with a fresh set of papers declaring me to be Doug Vetrano. I had his social security number and other vitals. This guy in Miami has a computer catalog with a million faces in it, and you simply point to the one you want, and presto, that face is on your driver's license. I picked a face that was somewhere between mine and Vetrano's. From Miami, I flew to Nassau, and that's where it got sticky. I presented myself to the bank, the United Bank of Wales. The main guy Vetrano had been talking to was a chap named Graham Dunlap. I presented all my fake papers, including a forged partnership resolution, on firm stationery, of course, which directed me to wire the money out as fast as it came in. Dunlap had not expected Mr. Vetrano, and he was quite surprised, even flattered, that someone from the firm would make the journey for such a routine matter. He fixed me coffee and sent a secretary out for croissants. I was eating one in his office when the wire came in.
He never thought about calling the firm?
No. And listen, Carl, I was prepared to bolt. If Dunlap had been the least bit suspicious, I would have slugged him, run from the building, grabbed a cab, and raced to the airport. I had 3 different tickets for 3 different flights.
Where would you have gone?
Well, I was still dead, remember? Probably to Brazil. I would have found a job as a bartender and spent the rest of my days on the beach. In retrospect, I might have been better off without the money. I had it, and they had to come after it. That's why I'm here now. Anyway, Dunlap asked the right questions, and my answers came out beautifully. He confirmed the wire was in, and I immediately authorized the wire out, to a bank in Malta.
All of it?
Almost all of it. Dunlap hesitated for a moment when he realized all the money was leaving his bank. I almost swallowed my tongue. He mentioned something about an administrative fee for his services, and I asked him what was customary. He turned into a slimy little twerp, said $50,000 would be appropriate, and I said fine. $50,000 stayed in the account and was later transferred to Dunlap. The bank is in downtown Nassau.
Was in downtown Nassau. It folded 6 months after you robbed it.
Yeah, so I heard. Too bad. When I left through the front door, my feet hit the sidewalk, and it was difficult to keep from sprinting like a madman through the traffic. I wanted to scream and leap from street to street, but I controlled myself. I jumped into the first empty cab, told the driver I was late for a flight, and off we went. The plane to Atlanta left in an hour. The one to Miami was an hour and a half. The one to LaGuardia was boarding, so I flew to New York.
With $90 million.
Minus $50,000 for old Dunlap. It was the longest flight of my life, Carl. I knocked down 3 martinis and was still nothing but nerves. I would close my eyes and see customs agents with machine guns waiting on me at the gate. I just knew Dunlap had gotten suspicious and called the firm, and that somehow they had tracked me to the airport and onto the flight. I have never wanted to get off a plane so badly in my life. We landed, taxied to the terminal, got off the plane. A camera flashed as we stepped into the gate area, and I thought, this is it, they've got me. It was some kid with a Kodak. I practically ran to the men's room where I sat on the toilet for 20 minutes. Next to my feet was a canvas overnight bag with all my worldly possessions.
Don't forget the $90 million.
Oh, yeah.
How'd the money get to Panama?
How do you know it went to Panama?
I'm the judge, Patrick. The cops talk to me. It's a small town.
It was in the wiring instructions from Nassau. The money went into a new account in Malta, then quickly on to Panama.
How'd you become such a wizard at wiring money?
Just took a little research. I worked on it for a year. Tell me, Carl, when did you hear that the money was missing?
Carl laughed and reclined even farther. He clasped his hands behind his head. Well, your pals at the firm did a poor job of keeping their little settlement quiet.
I'm shocked.
In fact, the whole town knew they were about to be filthy rich. They acted so serious about the secrecy, yet they were spending money like crazy. Haverack bought the biggest, blackest Mercedes ever made. Vetrano's architect was in the final stage of designing their new home, 11,000 square feet. Rapley signed a contract to buy an 80-foot sailboat, said he was contemplating retirement. I heard the private jet talk a few times. $30 million in legal fees would be hard to hide around here, but they didn't really try. They wanted people to know.
Sounds like a bunch of lawyers.
You struck on a Thursday, right?
Right, March 26th.
The next day, I was preparing to proceed with a civil trial when one of the lawyers got a call from the office. The news was that there were problems with the big settlement over at Bogan, Rapley, Vetrano, Haverack, and Lanigan. The money vanished, all of it, stolen by someone offshore.
Was my name mentioned?
Not the first day. It didn't take long, though. Word got out that the bank security cameras had captured someone vaguely resembling you. Other pieces fell into place, and the gossip roared around town.
Did you believe I did it?
At first, I was too shocked to believe anything. All of us were. We had buried you, put you to rest, said our prayers. It was impossible to believe. But as the days passed, the shock wore off, and the puzzle came together. The new will, the life insurance, the cremated corpse. You started getting suspicious. Then they found the office crawling with bugs. The FBI was questioning everyone around here. A week after it happened, it was pretty well accepted that you had pulled it off.
Were you proud of me?
I wouldn't say I was proud. Astonished, maybe. Perhaps stunned. There was, after all, a dead body. Then I was intrigued.
Not the slightest hint of admiration?
I don't remember it that way, Patrick. No, an innocent person had been murdered so you could steal the money. Plus, you left behind a wife and daughter.
The wife got a bundle. The child isn't mine.
I didn't know that at the time. No one did. No, I don't think you were admired around here.
What about my pals at the firm?
No one saw them for months. They got sued by Aresia. Other litigation followed. They had grossly overspent. So bankruptcy got them. Divorces, booze, it was awful. They self-destructed in textbook fashion.
Patrick crawled onto his bed and gently folded his legs. He savored this with a nasty smile. Husky stood and walked to the window.
"How long did you stay in New York?" he asked, peeking through the shades.
"About a week. I didn't want any of the money coming back into the States, so I arranged to have it wired to a bank in Toronto. The bank in Panama was a branch of the Bank of Ontario, so it was easy to wire in as much as I needed."
"You started spending?"
"Not much. I was a Canadian now, with good papers, a transplant from Vancouver, and the money allowed me to purchase a small apartment and obtain credit cards. I found a Portuguese instructor and studied the language 6 hours a day. I went to Europe several times so my passport would get used and scrutinized. Everything worked perfectly. After 3 months, I put the apartment on the market and went to Lisbon, where I studied the language for a couple of months. Then on August 5, 1992, I flew to Sao Paulo."
"Your Independence Day."
"Absolute freedom, Carl. I landed in that city with two small bags. I got in a cab, and I was soon lost in a sea of 20 million people. It was dark and raining, traffic was standing still, and I was in the back of a cab thinking to myself that no one in the world knew where I was. And no one would ever find me. I almost cried, Carl. It was sheer, unbridled freedom. I looked at the faces of the people racing down the sidewalks, and I thought to myself, I'm now one of them. I'm a Brazilian named Danilo, and I'll never be anybody else." Chapter 29 Sandy slept 3 hours on a hard mattress in a loft somewhere above the den, far away from her, and awoke with the early sun beaming through slits beneath the blinds. It was 6:30. They had said good night at 3, after 7 hours of intensely scouring documents and listening to dozens of surreptitious talks Patrick had amazingly captured. He showered and dressed and found his way down to the kitchen, where Leah sat in the breakfast nook with fresh coffee and a surprisingly alert face. She fixed him wheat toast with jam as he glanced at the newspapers. Sandy was ready to leave, to return to his office with the Aresia mess and sort it out on his own turf. "Any word from your father?" he asked. The early voices were quiet, the words scarce.
"No, but I can't call from here. I'll go to the market later and use the payphone."
"I'll say a prayer for him."
"Thanks."
They loaded the entire Aresia file into the trunk of his car and said goodbye. She promised to call him within 24 hours. She would not be leaving any time soon. Their client's problems had gone from serious to urgent. The early air was cool. It was October, after all, and even the coast felt a hint of autumn. She put on a parka and went for a walk on the beach, barefoot and bare-legged, with one hand in a pocket and the other holding her coffee. She hid behind sunglasses, which annoyed her. The beach was deserted. Why was she compelled to hide her face? Like all Carioca, she had spent a great deal of her life on the beach, the center of culture. Her childhood home had been her father's apartment in Ipanema, the poshest of Rio's neighborhoods, where every kid grew up on the beach. She was unaccustomed to long walks near the water without being surrounded by a million people happily sunning and playing. Her father had been one of the first to organize efforts against the unbridled development of Ipanema. He despised the increase of population and haphazard construction, and worked tirelessly with neighborhood groups. Such actions went against the typical Carioca attitude of live and let live, but with time came to be admired and even welcomed. As a lawyer, Eva still donated time to preservation groups in the neighborhoods of Ipanema and Leblon. The sun crept behind clouds, and the breeze picked up. She returned to the house as the seagulls followed and squawked overhead. She locked every door and window and drove 2 miles to a supermarket, where she planned to buy shampoo and fruit and to find the nearest possible payphone. She didn't see the man at first, and when she finally noticed him, he seemed to have been standing beside her forever. She was holding a bottle of hair conditioner when he sniffed, as if he had a cold. She turned, glanced from behind the sunglasses, and was startled by his sustained eye contact. He was 30 or 40, white, unshaven, but she didn't have time to notice anything else. He was staring at her, with rabid green eyes that glowed in the middle of a beach-bronzed face. She coolly walked away down the aisle with the conditioner. Maybe he was just a local character, a harmless pervert who lurked in the grocery and scared pretty vacationers. Perhaps everyone in the store knew his name and made excuses for him because he wouldn't harm an insect. Minutes later, she saw him again, this time hiding near the bakery, with his face behind a pizza crust, but his metallic eyes watching every move she made. Why was he hiding, covering his face? He wore shorts and sandals, she noticed. Panic hit hard through her chest and sent waves down her legs. Her first thought was to run, but she kept her cool long enough to find a small shopping basket. She had been spotted by whoever he was, and it was to her advantage to watch him as much as he was watching her. Who knew when she might see him again? She loitered in the produce department, next picked her way through the cheeses, and didn't see him for a long time. Then she saw him with his back to her, holding a gallon of milk. A few minutes later, she caught sight of him through the large front windows, walking through the parking lot, his head cocked to one side, talking into a cell phone, carrying nothing. What happened to the milk? She would have raced through a back door, but her car was parked in the front. She paid for the items as calmly as possible, but her hands shook as she took her change. There were 30 cars, including her rental, in the parking lot, and she knew she couldn't inspect them all. Not that she wanted to. He was in one of them. She simply wanted to leave without being followed. She quickly got in her car, left the lot, and turned in the direction of the beach house, though she knew she could never go back there. She drove a half a mile, then made an abrupt U-turn, just in time to see him behind her, three cars back, driving a new Toyota. His green eyes glanced away at the last second. Odd, she thought, that he wasn't covering them. Everything seemed odd at the moment. How odd that she was driving along a foreign highway in a foreign country with a fake passport proclaiming her to be someone she never wanted to be and going to a place that she had yet to determine. Yes, everything was odd and blurred and frightening as hell, and whatever needed and desperately wanted was to see Patrick so she could scream at him for an hour and throw rocks as well. This was not part of the deal. It was one thing for Patrick to be hunted for his past, but she had done nothing wrong. Not to mention Paulo. Being Brazilian, she normally drove with one foot on the gas and the other on the brake, and the traffic along the beach badly needed a good dose of her native driving. But she had to be calm. You don't panic when you're on the run, Patrick had said many times. You think, you watch, you plan. She watched the cars behind her. She obeyed all highway rules. Always know where you are, Patrick had told her. She had studied the road atlas for hours. She turned north and stopped at a gas station to see what she attracted. Nothing. The man with the green eyes was not behind her. But this was of no comfort. He knew she had seen him. He'd been caught. He'd simply called ahead with his little cell phone, and now the rest of them were watching. An hour later, she entered the airport terminal in Pensacola and waited 80 minutes for a flight to Miami. Any flight would have suited her. The one to Miami happened to be the soonest. It would prove to be disastrous. She waited behind a magazine in a coffee bar and watched everything that moved. A security guard enjoyed looking at her, and she found him difficult to ignore. Otherwise, the airport was almost devoid of human activity. The flight to Miami was by turboprop commuter and seemed to take forever. 18 of the 24 seats were vacant, and the other 5 passengers looked harmless. She even managed a brief nap. In Miami, she hid in an airport lounge for an hour, sipping expensive water and watching the throngs come and go. At the varied counter, she bought a first-class ticket to Sao Paulo, one way. She wasn't sure why. Sao Paulo wasn't home, but it was certainly in the right direction. Maybe she would hide there in a nice hotel for a few days. She'd be closer to her father, wherever he was. Planes were leaving for 100 destinations. Why not visit her country? As it routinely does, the FBI issued an alert to customs and immigration personnel as well as to the airlines. This one specified a young woman, aged 31, traveling under a Brazilian passport, real name of Eva Miranda, but probably using an alias. Having learned the identity of her father, getting her real name was a simple matter. When Leia Parrish walked through a passport checkpoint at Miami International, she wasn't expecting trouble in front of her. She was still looking for the men behind her. Her Lea Parish passport had proven quite reliable in the past 2 weeks. But the customs agent had seen the alert an hour earlier during a coffee break. He pushed an alarm button on his scanner while he slowly examined every word of the passport. The hesitation at first was annoying. Then Lea realized something was wrong. The travelers at the other booths were breezing through, barely slowing long enough to open their passports and having the approvals nodded back at them. A supervisor in a navy jacket appeared from nowhere and huddled with the agent.
"Could you step in here, Ms. Parish?" he asked politely, but with no room for discussion.
He was pointing at a row of doors down the wide corridor.
"Is there a problem?" she insisted.
"Not really, just a few questions." He was waiting for her. A uniformed guard with mace and a gun on his waist was waiting, too. The supervisor was holding her passport. Dozens of passengers behind her were watching.
"Questions about what?" she demanded as she walked with the supervisor and the guard to the second door.
"Just a few questions," he repeated, opening the door and escorting her into a square room with no windows. A holding room. She noticed the name of Rivera on his lapel. He didn't look to be Hispanic.
"Give me the passport," she demanded as soon as they were alone and the door was closed.
"Not so fast, Miss Parish. I need to ask you a few questions."
"And I don't have to answer them."
"Please relax. Have a seat. Can I get you some coffee or water?"
"No."
"Is this a valid address in Rio?"
"It certainly is."
"Where did you arrive from?"
"Pensacola."
"Your flight?"
"Airlink 855.
"And your destination?"
"Sao Paulo."
"Where in Sao Paulo?"
"Maybe that's a private matter."
"Business or pleasure?"
"Why does it matter?"
"It matters. Your passport lists your home in Rio, so where will you be staying in Sao Paulo?"
"A hotel."
"And the name of the hotel?"
She hesitated as she struggled to grab the name of a hotel, and the little interval was deadly.
The Intercontinental," she finally said, without the slightest hint of truthfulness. He wrote it down, then said, "And we can assume the room there is reserved in the name of Lea Parish?"
"Of course,"
she said, snapping back nicely. But one quick phone call would prove she was lying. "Where's your luggage?" he asked. Another crack in the facade, and this one even more revealing. She hesitated, glanced away, and said,
"I'm traveling light."
Someone knocked on the door. Rivera opened it slightly, took a sheet of paper, and whispered to his unseen colleague. Lea sat down and tried to relax. The door closed, and Rivera studied his evidence. "According to our records, you entered the country 8 days ago, here in Miami, on a flight from London, which originated in Zurich. 8 days and no luggage. Seems odd, doesn't it?"
"Is it a crime to travel light?"
she asked. "No, but it is a crime to use a false passport, at least here in the U.S. She looked at the passport lying on the table near him, and she knew it was as phony as could be.
"It's not a false passport," she said indignantly.
"Do you know a person by the name of Eva Miranda?" Rivera asked, and Lea couldn't keep her chin up. Her heart stopped, and her face fell, and she knew the chase was over. Rivera knew they had snared another one. "I'll have to contact the FBI," he said. "It will take some time."
"Am I under arrest?" she asked.
"Not yet."
"I'm a lawyer.
We know. And we have the right to detain you for questioning. Our offices are on the lower level. Let's go." She was led away hurriedly, clutching her purse, her eyes still covered. The long table was piled with papers and files, with crumpled sheets from legal pads and napkins and empty cups and even half-eaten sandwiches from the hospital cafeteria. Lunch had been 5 hours earlier, but neither lawyer had thought of dinner. Time was being kept outside the room. Inside, it didn't matter. Both men were barefoot. Patrick wore a T-shirt and gym shorts. Sandy wore a very wrinkled cotton button-down, khakis, no socks, the same attire he'd put on hours earlier in the beach house. The Aresia box was empty in a corner, its contents all on the table. The door opened while it was being knocked on, and Agent Joshua Cutter entered before he was asked. He stayed by the door. "This is a private meeting," Sandy said, very near Cutter's face. The documents on the table could not be seen by anyone. Patrick walked to the door and helped shield the view. "Why don't you knock before you enter?" he said angrily.
"Sorry," Cutter said calmly. "I'll just be a minute. Just thought you'd want to know that we have Eva Miranda in custody. Caught her sneaking through the Miami airport on her way home to Brazil, fake passport and all."
Patrick froze and tried to think of something to say.
"Eva?" Sandy asked. "Yeah, also known as Leia Parrish. That's what her fake passport calls her."
Cutter was looking at Patrick while answering Sandy.
"Where is she?" Patrick asked, stunned.
"Jail, in Miami."
Patrick turned and walked along the table. Jail would be horrible anywhere, but jail in Miami had a particularly ominous ring to it.
"Do you have a number where we can call her?" Sandy asked.
"No. She has the right to a telephone."
"We're working on it. Get me a number, okay?"
"We'll see."
Cutter continued to watch Patrick and ignore Sandy.
"She was in a hurry. No luggage, not one bag, just trying to sneak back to Brazil, leaving you behind."
"Shut up," Patrick said.
"You can leave now," Sandy said. "Just thought you'd want to know," Cutter said with a smile and left.
Patrick sat down and gently massaged his temples. His head had been aching before Cutter arrived, now it was splitting. He and Eva had gone over and over the three scenarios which she would face if they caught him. First, and the one according to plan, was that she would remain in the shadows, assisting Sandy and moving at will. Second, she might be caught by Stefano and Aricia, which was by far the most frightening possibility. Third, the FBI could catch her, which was not nearly as terrifying as the second, but did pose enormous problems. At least she was safe. They had not discussed this fourth scenario, a return to Brazil without him. He would not believe it was abandonment. Sandy quietly gathered files and cleaned up the table.
"What time did you leave her?" Patrick asked.
"About 8. She was fine, Patrick, I told you that."
"No mention of Miami or Brazil?"
"No, none whatsoever. I left with the impression she would be at the beach house for a while. She told me she leased it for a month."
"Then she got scared.
Why else would she run?"
"I don't know."
"Find a lawyer in Miami, Sandy, and quickly."
"I know a couple."
"She must be scared to death."
Chapter 30 It was after 6, so Haverack was probably in a casino at the blackjack table, sipping free whiskey and looking for women. Rumors about his gambling debts were abundant. No doubt Rapley was locked away in his attic, a place the rest of the world preferred him to be. The secretaries and paralegals were gone. Doug Vetrano locked the front door of the building and walked to the rear office, the largest and nicest one, where Charlie Bogan was waiting behind his desk with his sleeves rolled up. Patrick had managed to bug every office except the senior partners, a fact Bogan had relied on heavily during the roaring brawls that followed the loss of the money. If Bogan wasn't in his office or somewhere in the very near vicinity, it was locked with a deadbolt. His partners had been much too careless, he had reminded them repeatedly. Especially Vetrano, whose phone had been used during those last fateful chats with Graham Dunlap offshore, which was how Patrick had learned the direction of the money. This had been rehashed to the point of near fistfights. Bogan could not, in all fairness, claim he suspected espionage in his own firm. If so, why hadn't he warned his more indifferent partners? He'd simply been cautious and lucky. Important conversations were held in Bogan's office. It took only seconds to engage the deadbolt. He kept the only key. Not even the janitors could get in without Bogan's presence. Vetrano closed the door firmly and dropped into the soft leather chair across the desk.
"I saw the senator this morning," Bogan said. "He called me to his house."
Bogan's mother and the senator's father were siblings. The senator was 10 years older than Bogan.
"Is he in a good mood?" Vetrano asked. "I wouldn't call it that. He wanted an update on Lanigan, and I told him what I knew,"
Still no sign of the money. He's very nervous about what Lanigan might know. I assured him, as I've done many times, that all communications with him were done in this office, and that this office was clean, so he shouldn't worry about what Lanigan might know. But he's worried.
Of course he's worried.
He asked me again if there was any document tying him to Aresia, and I again said no.
Which, of course, is true.
Yes. There are no documents with the senator's name. Everything with him was verbal. Most of it was done on the golf course. I've told him this 1,000 times, but he wanted to hear it again in light of Patrick's return.
You didn't tell him about the closet?
No.
They both watched the dust on Bogan's desk and relived what happened in the closet. In January of 1992, a month after the Justice Department approved the Aresia settlement, and about 2 months before they were to receive the money, Aresia had popped in one day, unscheduled and unannounced, and in a foul mood. Patrick was still around, though his funeral was only 3 weeks away. The firm had already begun an extensive renovation of its offices, and for this reason Bogan couldn't meet with Aresia in his office. Painters were on ladders, drop cloths covered the furniture. They got the combative Aresia into a small meeting room across the hall from Bogan's, a room everyone referred to simply as the closet, because of its size. A small square table with a chair on each side, no windows. The ceiling was slanted because a stairway ran above it. Vetrano was fetched because he was second in command, and a meeting of sorts commenced. It didn't last long. Aresia was chafed because the lawyers were about to earn $30 million. Now that his settlement had been approved, reality had hit hard, and he thought $30 million in legal fees was obscene. Things turned nasty quickly as Bogan and Vetrano held their ground. They offered to find their contract for legal services, but Aresia cared nothing for it. In the heat of the moment, Aresia asked how much of the $30 million the senator would get. Bogan grew hostile and said it was none of his business. Aresia claimed that it was his business because, after all, the money was his, and then he launched into a windy diatribe attacking the senator and all politicians in general. He made much of the fact that the senator had been working so hard in Washington to pressure the Navy, the Pentagon, and the Justice Department to settle his claim. "How much will he get?" he kept asking. Bogan kept slipping the punches. He would say only that the senator would be taken care of. He reminded Aresia that he had carefully chosen the firm because of its political connections, and he hotly added that $60 million in Aresia's pocket was not such a bad deal, considering how the claim was bogus to begin with. Too much was said. Aresia proposed a fee of only $10 million. Bogan and Vetrano rejected it outright. He stormed out of the closet, swearing every step of the way. There were no phones in the closet, but 2 mics were found. One was under the table, hidden in a corner where 2 brackets joined, stuck in place by black putty. The second was placed between 2 dusty, ancient law books on the only shelf in the room. The books were for decorative purposes. After the shock of the vanishing fortune and the subsequent discovery by Stefano of all the bugs and wires, Bogan and Vetrano didn't discuss the closet meeting for a long time. Maybe it would just disappear. They never spoke to Aresia about it, primarily because he had sued them so quickly and now hated the mention of their names. The incident faded from their memories. Maybe it never happened after all. Now that Patrick was back, they had been forced to timidly confront it. There was always the chance that the mics had malfunctioned, or that Patrick in his haste had missed it. There were certainly enough other bugs for him to absorb and assimilate. In fact, they had decided there was a very good chance the closet meeting had been missed by Patrick. "Surely he wouldn't keep the tapes for 4 years, would he?" Vetrano asked. But Bogan didn't answer. He sat with his fingers locked over his stomach and watched the dust settle on his desk. Oh, what could have been! He would get $5 million, the senator the same. No bankruptcy, no divorce. He would still have his wife and family, his home and his stature. He could have taken the 5 and made it 10 by now, and 20 before long, serious big money, and the freedom to do anything. It was all there, a feast on a table. Then Patrick snatched it. The giddiness of finding Patrick had lasted a couple of days, then vanished slowly when it became obvious that the money was not following him back to Biloxi. With each passing day, the money actually seemed farther away.
"Do you think we'll get the money, Charlie?" Vetrano asked, barely audible, his eyes on the floor.
He hadn't called him Charlie in years. Such familiarity was unheard of in a firm with so much hatred.
"No," he said. There was a long pause. "We'll be lucky if we're not indicted."
With an hour of serious phone work ahead of him, Sandy made the most troubling one first. Sitting in his parked car in the hospital lot, he called his wife and told her he'd be in very late, so late that he might be forced to stay in Biloxi. His son was playing in a junior high football game. He apologized, blamed everything on Patrick, and said he'd explain later. She took it much better than expected. He caught a secretary working late at his office and collected phone numbers from her. He knew two lawyers in Miami, neither of whom happened to be at the office at 7:15. The home number for one went unanswered. The other had a private listing. He made a series of calls to lawyers he knew in New Orleans and finally got the home number of Mark Burke, a highly regarded criminal defense specialist in Miami. Burke was not delighted at receiving the call during dinner, but he listened anyway. Sandy gave the 10-minute version of the Patrick saga, including the latest development with Eva in jail somewhere in Miami. Thus the call. Burke showed an interest and claimed a thorough knowledge of immigration law as well as criminal procedure. He would make two calls, after dinner. Sandy agreed to phone him back in an hour. It took three calls to locate Cutter and 20 minutes of wheedling before he would agree to meet for coffee at a donut shop. Sandy drove there and, while waiting for Cutter, called Burke again. Burke reported that Eva Miranda was indeed in custody in a federal detention center in Miami. She had not yet been formally charged with any crime, but it was early. There was no way to see her tonight, and it would be difficult to see her tomorrow. Under the law, the FBI and the U.S. Customs Service can hold an alien caught traveling under a bogus passport for up to 4 days before a release can be applied for. "Makes sense," Burke explained, considering the circumstances. "These people tend to disappear quickly." Burke had been in the detention center several times, visiting clients, and as these places went, it was not bad. She was in her own private cell and generally safe. With luck, she would have access to a telephone in the morning. Without providing too much detail, Sandy stressed that there was no rush in getting her released. There were people looking for her on the outside. Burke promised to pull strings early in the morning and try to see her. His fee would be $10,000, which Sandy agreed to pay. He hung up as Cutter swaggered into the donut shop and sat at a table by the front window as promised. Sandy locked his car and followed him in. Dinner was packaged food, microwaved and served on a well-worn plastic tray. Though she was hungry, the thought of eating it hardly crossed her mind. It was delivered to her cinder-blocked cell by two heavy women in uniform, keys dangling from chains around their waists. One asked how she was doing. She mumbled something in Portuguese, and they left her alone. The door was thick metal with a small square hole in it. Voices of other women prisoners could occasionally be heard, but the place was generally quiet. She had never been in jail before, not even as a lawyer. Other than Patrick, she couldn't recall a friend who'd been incarcerated. The initial shock yielded to fear, then to humiliation at being caged like a criminal. Only the thought of her poor father kept her focused during the first hours. No doubt his conditions were far worse than hers. She prayed that they were not hurting him. The praying came easier in jail. She prayed for her father, and she prayed for Patrick. She resisted the temptation to blame him for her troubles, though it would have been easy. Most of the blame rested with her. She had panicked and run too quickly. Patrick had taught her how to move without leaving a trail, how to vanish. The mistake was her fault, not his. The false passport charges were minor, she decided, and could be dealt with in short order. In a violent country, without enough jail cells, surely such a simple offense from such a non-criminal could be handled swiftly, with a small fine and a quick deportation. She found comfort in the money. Tomorrow she would demand an attorney, a good one, with clout. Phone calls would be made to officials in Brasilia. She knew their names. If necessary, the money could be used to bully everyone in sight. She would be out before long, then back home to rescue her father. She would hide somewhere in Rio. It would be simple. The cell was warm and locked and guarded by lots of people with guns. It was a safe place, she decided. The man who hurt Patrick and now had her father couldn't touch her. She turned off the ceiling light and stretched out on the narrow bunk. The FBI would be anxious to tell Patrick that she was in custody, so he probably knew by now. She could see him with his legal pad, running lines here and there, analyzing this latest development from an amazing variety of angles. By now, Patrick had conceived no less than 10 ways to rescue her. And he wouldn't sleep until he had the list pared down to the best 3 plans. The fun was in the planning, he always said. Cutter ordered a caffeine-free soda and a chocolate donut. He was off duty, so the standard dark suit and white shirt were replaced by jeans and short sleeves. Smirking came naturally for him. Now that they had found the girl and locked her up, he was especially cocky. Sandy ate a ham sandwich in 4 bites. It was almost 9 p.m. Lunch had been hospital food with Patrick a long time ago. "We need to have a serious talk," he said. The shop was packed and his voice was low. "I'm listening," Cutter said. Sandy swallowed, wiped his mouth, leaned even closer, and said, "Don't take this the wrong way, but we need to include other people."
"Like who?"
"Like the people above you, people in Washington." Cutter pondered this for a minute as he watched the traffic move along Highway 90. The Gulf was 100 yards away.
"Sure," he said, "but I gotta tell him something."
Sandy glanced around. Not a single person was even casually looking their way. "What if I can prove that the Aresia claim against Platt and Rockland was completely fraudulent, that he conspired with the Bogan firm to defraud the government, and that Bogan's cousin, the senator, was a part of the conspiracy and was to have received several million bucks under the table?"
"A wonderful story."
"I can prove it."
"And if we believe it, then we're supposed to allow Mr. Lanigan to make some type of restitution and walk away?"
"Perhaps."
"Not so fast. There's still the matter of the dead body."
Cutter casually took a bite of his donut and chewed it thoughtfully. Then,
"What kind of proof?"
"Documents, recorded phone calls, all sorts of things."
"Admissible in court?"
"Most of it."
"Enough for convictions?"
"A box full."
"Where's the box?"